Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics Iowa style and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, broadcasting tonight from Disney World in Orlando, Florida, and joined as always through the magic of electronics by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Good to be with you again, Laura, on this Thanksgiving week.
Yes, absolutely, Dennis.
We have a heck of a lot to talk about. Let's get right into it. First, the end of the John Deere strike last week, the five-week-long walkout by Deere by members of the United Auto Workers Union ended last Wednesday night. They reached agreement. Let's talk about the agreement, what it means, and why the workers changed. They turned it down twice, a contract twice. They agreed to it last Wednesday night. What happened?
Yes. Well, the contract that they approved last week was very similar to the second contract that was voted down, but it was quite different from the first deal, which 90% of the workforce voted against in October. That one would have involved raises of only 5 to 6%. There were some issues with pensions. New hires after November 1st would not be part of the pension program. And there were some other problems. But the second offer was very close to the final deal that was ratified last week. There were some small changes related to performance pay, but that doesn't even affect everyone in the UAW. I was surprised that the vote wasn't closer. It turned out to be about 61% yes and 39% no. And all of the locals in Iowa had higher the support for the contract increased at all the locals. There was only one local that still voted against it, but that was Waterloo. And it was pretty close there. It was a 44% yes vote. Whereas in the vote that they had in early November, it was less than a third of those Waterloo workers who supported the contract.
Let's talk about what the workers got from this new contract.
So they get a 10% raise. They get more performance pay. They get higher increases, salary increases in 2023 and 2025. They get rid of that third tier for the pension system. So the new hires, the future hires will still be part of the pension program. That was very important to the union. The people who voted against the contract were unhappy that there are still more generous terms for the workers who have been there for a long time, since before 1997. They wanted to see the elimination of those two tiers. But overall, it was a much improved contract. There was also a signing bonus. Most of the workers are going to get about $8,500 just on the contract being ratified. And so overall, it was partly that many people thought it was a good deal, and partly that many workers, even if they still weren't satisfied, they weren't convinced that holding out longer was going to get them a better deal. And the head of the local in Dubuque sent out a message to his members saying, look, voting down this contract does not force Deere to agree to any of our terms. And in fact, it doesn't even force them to stay at the negotiating table. And he expressed concern that if the contract was voted down again, that Deere might bring in strike breakers. They might take other measures. They might not come back and negotiate, and that this thing could drag on for months. As we've talked about before, the last time John Deere workers were on strike in 1986, it wasn't resolved until a little more than 5 months afterwards. And that's a really long time to be trying to subsist on the strike pay. The UAW is paying people about $275 a week, and that's a lot less than they would be making back on the job. So many factors came together. I did see some people complaining on social media that they felt that Deere, they used scare tactics to get people to agree to this contract. But as we saw, the majority, and most of the locals, the majority supported it by a pretty clear margin.
What's your assessment of the deal that they got? 10% immediately, as you said, 5% twice over the next 3 years. What's your assessment? How good is this?
Well, I mean, from talking with people, it sounds like it is, relatively speaking, it's a pretty good deal. Many workplaces in Iowa don't have labor unions at all, but even compared to the contracts that many unionized workers have, it's pretty good. There aren't that many employers that still have a good pension program. So I think overall it was reasonable. Now, I do think that Deere, with its multi-billion dollar profits, could have afforded to give more. I certainly wouldn't agree that this was the most generous contract that the company could afford. But I wasn't convinced that the company was going to give a lot more. And clearly, a lot of the UAW members weren't convinced of that either.
There was a tragic side note to this. The man who spearheaded the contract talks that ended the Deere strike died from the coronavirus. Let's talk about Curtis Templeton.
Yes, he was a leader of the local in Ankeny. That's the UAW Local 450. And he had been directly involved in the negotiations. He also, the Des Moines Register published a picture of him. This was not even 2 weeks ago, testifying at the court hearing. You may remember that John Deere tried to get an injunction to limit the number of people who could be on the picket line. And he was testifying in court on that. And the brothers in the union said afterwards that he had been battling through what he thought was just a cold. And of course, it turned out to be much worse. And he was in the ICU for about 12 days. Near the end, they took him to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. But unfortunately, they were not able to save him.
A very sad story involving Curtis Templeton. But the end story for John Deere, 10,000 workers, Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas, back on the job after accepting a new contract. There's another number.
A six-year contract. And I think that, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens when some other contracts come up in the next year or two, whether this, the result of this strike emboldens workers, more workers to reject offers from their own companies.
Matter of fact, in some of the national newspapers, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, some speculation that this year contract could indeed be a forerunner for future negotiations.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the coronavirus. The number 10,000 comes up then very closely to 10,000. Unfortunately, today, the State Department of Health in Iowa reported the number of new cases, 9,560 coronavirus cases in Iowa over the previous 7 days. That is up almost 1,000 from Friday. In addition, 102 more deaths from the virus took place, reported in Iowa last week. That brought the total number of deaths to 7,268. 14-day positivity rate, 10.3% now, the highest it's been in a long time. There are more numbers, Laura. You know them, and we can talk about them. The bottom line is this is all going in the wrong direction now.
It is, and it still is largely a pandemic of the unvaccinated, but what we're seeing is the number of hospitalized people who are vaccinated is creeping up just a little bit now, a little bit more than a quarter. And I imagine that most of that is a nursing home residence. You know, a lot of people who have underlying health conditions or are over age 80, they don't build up as strong an immune response. So even if they're fully vaccinated, they're still quite vulnerable. And Iowa still has dozens of nursing home outbreaks. And I think that that is responsible for some of what we're seeing with the hospitalizations of the vaccinated. But the vast majority of people ending up with severe illness or dying are still unvaccinated. And what's disturbing is that even in some of the most heavily vaccinated counties, so I was reading today about the latest COVID-19 numbers in Johnson County, that's Iowa City and Dubuque. And Johnson County has the highest vaccination rate in the state, and Dubuque is up there. And yet they are still having some of their highest case numbers that they've had since last November. And part of it is there's a lot of spread in schools and daycares where many of the children are still too young to be vaccinated. Partly it's that there are pockets that the Dubuque public health director was saying there are still zip codes in Dubuque County that have very low vaccination rates, and that's where they're seeing a lot of the cases. So this Delta variant is finding people. I mean, it's, as we've talked about before, you're either going to get the vaccine or you're going to get the coronavirus, because this thing is very, very transmissible, more than the variants that were circulating last year.
Right. And as you have said, of those hospitalized, to be specific, more than 73% are not vaccinated. The people who are getting sickest have not been vaccinated. And it's such a simple thing, as we've talked for so long here. Vaccinations are free, they're easily accessible, and yet a specific part of the population will not get it.
Yeah, I just had my booster shot on Sunday, and it was very easy to schedule. There were a lot of available appointments, and it's unfortunate. I mean, especially in some of the counties have significantly higher case rates and death rates. And I don't know what it's going to take to bring people around to more people getting vaccinated. I've been asking the state public health department when they're going to start encouraging people again to wear masks in public. We really aren't hearing anything about that. But with the community spread numbers as high as they are, people who are out in public spaces, indoor public spaces, really should be wearing a mask. That's what all of the public health guidance from the CDC and many other authorities, they all agree on that point.
Congratulations on getting your booster. I was able to get mine a couple of weeks ago, as was my wife. Very simple to get it. And bottom line is, I think where we're going on this, and we're no medical doctors, but everybody is leading this way. This is going to be something we're going to have to do for the next years, as we do with the flu, to get a flu vaccine every year. We're probably going to need a booster, right?
Yes. I mean, it doesn't look like we're going to get the vaccination numbers that we would need to really eradicate it from the population the way we did with the smallpox or polio.
Meanwhile, in a federal court, an appeals court is soon going to decide on whether to keep in place that state injunction blocking Iowa's ban on school mask mandates. And you've been following this. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, this was a panel of three judges who heard the case late last week, and members of the public could call in and listen. And it's frustrating. You know, they say don't try to predict based on the oral arguments, but it's hard not to do that. One of the judges strongly seemed sympathetic to the state's position that this injunction was an overreach and was not necessary. Another judge seemed fairly skeptical of the state's position, but then he didn't ask a lot of questions later in the hearing. So it was hard to say, but he said at one point that he felt that the state's brief was making a different argument every paragraph. And then the third judge, Jane Kelly, who I believe is the only Barack Obama nominee on the on that circuit, she really didn't ask very many questions. So it was hard to see. It was hard to guess where she's coming down. So I would venture to say it may not be a unanimous ruling, but any day now, the Eighth Circuit could decide whether to leave that injunction in place and allow school districts to have mask mandates, or they could narrow it in some way, or they could completely lift the injunction. There are a lot of different things they could do. And the attorney representing the ACLU of Iowa and the disabilities groups and the families, they were trying to encourage the court that if you do narrow in the injunction, don't narrow it too much. Make sure that it's clear that school districts have the ability to accommodate families with disabilities.
And just remind people, the state had passed a law banning school districts and municipalities from imposing mask mandates. A federal judge stayed that involving school districts, and many of the state's biggest school districts did almost immediately impose mask mandates.
Yes, most of the ones that were subject to the lawsuit did impose the mask mandates. And that was, in some ways, that weakened the state's argument, because their argument at the district court level in Iowa was, you giving the plaintiffs what they want isn't going to get you anywhere, because the court ruling wouldn't automatically mean that there would be a mask mandate in these districts. It would require further action by the schools. But then when most of these school districts immediately reimposed the mask mandate, and the other thing the ACLU's attorney was saying was, we're not necessarily saying that every single school in Iowa has to have a 100% mask mandate, but we need to allow school districts to have the flexibility. Maybe there are some schools that are very small where maybe only some classrooms would need to mandate masks, or maybe there are other ones where certain buildings would have stricter rules than others, but we need to let school districts make those calls for themselves. And that was the argument. So that, again, that is a possible middle ground that the appeals court could find.
And if that decision comes down this week, we will have it for you next Monday night live on Capitol Week. Meanwhile, a new Des Moines Register poll showed that more than half of Iowans support a new state law saying employers who require coronavirus vaccinations must allow exemptions for workers who cite religious or medical reasons. Again, a controversial law, and most of the state apparently supports it.
Yes. I mean, of course, there's a big on all of these COVID numbers, questions that the Des Moines Register polls ask. There is a big partisan split, and we see more rural Republican voters supporting the Republican position on these laws. And then other voters are more inclined to support the vaccine mandates or some of the other or to oppose the law banning mask mandates. So but it's an issue that's divided our country. I mean, you see it in other states as well. It's very divisive. And I don't really know why. I mean, other countries don't seem to have as many political disputes over the COVID mitigation measures. There are isolated protests in other countries, but I haven't seen it become so closely aligned with a partisan issue as it is in the United States. And the people I follow, somebody in Michigan who plots for different states, the county level vaccination rates on one axis, and then the vote for Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. And it's a really strong correlation. And it's not just in Iowa, it's all over the country. Even in blue states like California, the red counties have very low vaccination rates. And so it's just something I think that this is going to be a long lasting political divide in the country, the same way as you were saying, this virus is probably going to be with us for a long time.
Indeed. It is 15 minutes after the hour in whatever time zone you are listening to us, and you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capitol Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. We are here every week at this time to talk politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. In another story last week, a big one, word that a state audit on Iowa government spending accused Governor Reynolds of using nearly $450,000 in federal coronavirus relief money to pay the salaries for 21 staff members for several months last year. A story broken by a good friend of mine, by the way, whom I'm with every Monday night at this hour, Laura Bellin. That is your story. Congratulations. It made major front page news across the state. Talk about it, please.
Yes. Well, it was truly, it was one of the biggest scoops that I've had. I've been interested in the governor's office budget for a long time because the governor continues to hire more staff and more staff, and her budget appropriation has gone up somewhat, but it's seemingly not enough to account for all of the staff she'd hired. So for several years, I've been requesting what are called salary sharing agreements that show which other agencies are paying the salaries of some staff in the governor's office. And what I found in 2020 when I requested these agreements, and I've reviewed these, as I said, several years in a row. Normally, these agreements run through the end of the fiscal year, which was on June 30th. But all of the salary sharing agreements that were signed in 2020 ran through March 14th, 2020. And that made me think, I wonder if they're tapping some COVID-19 related funding stream to cover these salaries. And so I made further records requests, and that's exactly what I found out. So a year ago in September is when I first reported that the governor was spending nearly $450,000 in the CARES Act money on her staff salaries. And then later in October and in December, I followed up on how the money was being routed through the Homeland Security Agency. And that was a key point of the state audit that was released last week, were these spreadsheets that came out of the Homeland Security Agency. And they showed that the amount of money that was calculated was based on the budget shortfall that they needed to cover in the governor's office budget. But then they changed headings on these spreadsheets so that instead of fiscal year 2020 shortfall, it said COVID-19 personnel costs. So, and instead of amount needed to balance appropriation, it said COVID-19 costs not budgeted for. So it was just literally changing the headings. And so it was almost like a smoking gun for the state audit. So right now, the governor's office is still saying that they are confident that they are allowed to use the money in this way. But the state auditor has been saying that the governor's office has not produced the documentation to back up that this was a legitimate use of the CARES Act money. And one thing that I also thought was interesting was that one of the governor's top aides, who was very deeply involved in the coronavirus response, was not part of this group that was paid with CARES Act money because his salary had already been moved to another state agency. And so that made me wonder, you know, was this really based on who was working on the pandemic, or was it based on whose salaries they needed to get off the books in some way?
So what happens next?
Well, next, the state auditor and the governor's office, I guess, are going to work out this documentation issue. The governor's office said that they're working with the U.S. Treasury Department, but the Treasury's Deputy Inspector General, Richard Delmar, told me that they have not opened an audit of this, and this is something that the state auditor and governor have to resolve, and that he's awaiting that resolution. So he did not concur that the governor's office is working directly with his office. So theoretically, the state auditor recommended that the governor pay the money back before December 31st. Theoretically, if that doesn't happen, the Treasury Department could initiate an audit sometime next year, and then either the expenditure would be deemed allowable or the state might have to pay that money back. And again, we're talking about $448,449. So, you know, it's not as much as the workday spending, which was $21 million, but it's still a significant amount of money that could be put to other uses. And that's why the state auditor is encouraging the governor to do that so that it can be spent on other pandemic response measures before December 31st.
And I'm just going to bet that you're going to continue following this story.
Oh, yes. This is what I will be staying on top of.
I have said this a number of times over the past year that you and I have been on the air. I believe this, and this is not just being nice to you on this Monday night. I think you, Laura, are one of the finest political reporters in all of Iowa, and we are pleased to have you on Monday nights on KHOI, and I'm pleased to be with you.
Thank you. I enjoy having a forum to speak in depth about Iowa politics for 30 minutes every week. That's great for me.
You got it. There was a big story this Monday afternoon as we go live on Monday night. A judge has ruled that an Iowa law preventing Medicaid from covering gender confirmation related surgery violates the state's Civil Rights Act and the state constitution. This is a very big decision on Monday.
Yes. So the two plaintiffs are being represented by the ACLU of Iowa. This is a transgender man and a transgender woman. They are both Medicaid recipients. They both receive other services through Medicaid, but Iowa's DHS has had a longstanding policy for decades that they will not pay for gender-affirming surgery for trans Iowans who are on Medicaid. So in March of 2019, the Iowa Supreme Court considered a lawsuit that was brought by different plaintiffs, and they ruled that this state policy violates the Iowa Civil Rights Act. The Iowa Civil Rights Act, since 2007, has included protections for sexual orientation and gender identity. So the Iowa Supreme Court did not rule on whether it was unconstitutional because they determined they don't need to go there because they can just say it violates the state Civil Rights Act. So that was in March of 2019. Right away, the state legislature, before the adjournment in 2019, this was in late April, they drafted a last-minute provision. They added it to the Health and Human Services budget that basically carved out an exemption to the Iowa Civil Rights Act just for that area that said that you can't be required to cover gender-affirming surgery for transgender people. And so the ACLU immediately filed a lawsuit in already in May of 2019, right after the governor signed this into law. But that lawsuit was eventually dismissed because a judge ruled that these plaintiffs needed to exhaust their administrative remedies first. So they needed to go through the motions of asking the DHS to approve and having Medicaid deny the surgery and so on. So that involved a significant delay. So they came back. This is a new lawsuit that was filed in April of this year. The same plaintiffs who filed in 2019, and they are saying now they've gone through the process, their Medicaid, the insurance companies denied the coverage, Iowa DHS denied the coverage, and this time the district court in Polk County found that this law that carves out an exception in the Iowa Civil Rights Act, this does violate the Iowa Constitution's provision on equal protection. And the ruling borrowed heavily from the Varnum decision, which was the marriage equality decision from 2009, and said that these are similarly situated people. If these are surgeries that other people who are not transgender can get similar surgeries covered through Medicaid, this is procedures that doctors have affirmed is medically necessary, that medical associations say are medically necessary. And so it is unconstitutional for the state of Iowa to say, just because you're transgender, we won't give you the surgery that other Medicaid recipients would be able to access.
A big decision, and we'll be hearing more about this in the next days and weeks. The governor very unhappy, as we are told on this Monday, about this decision. Let's move on to a new Des Moines Register poll published last week showing that half of all Iowans say the mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th was an insurrection and a threat to democracy. 22% say the event was unfortunate, but it's in the past, so there's no need to worry about it. Again, this is part of the great partisan divide, though, in Iowa and across the country, because Democrats and Republicans simply don't agree on this.
Yes, this was an amazing split that 93% of the Democrats in the survey said what happened on January 6th was an insurrection and threat to democracy, but only 20% of the Republicans thought so. 32% of the Republicans thought it was an unfortunate event, but it's in the past. And then actually 36%. So that struck me as a very large number, said it was a political protest protected under the First Amendment. And remember, I mean, this was storming the Capitol and trying to, and successfully for a time at least, interrupting the Electoral College count. So really a remarkable poll finding. And as you said, the overall numbers for the sample split right down the middle, with about 50% saying this was an insurrection. And for the independents, those are people not affiliated with either party, they also came down about 50% saying that they thought it was an insurrection. So again, this is just an event that will continue, that Americans will continue to view differently. And I think that whatever congressional investigations or FBI investigations are ongoing are probably not going to change the way many people see those events.
We have 5 minutes left, and we have two or three more things to talk about, including another new Register poll that showed nearly one third of Iowans doubt that next year's election results are going to be counted as voters intended. And there's a big partisan split on this as well.
Yes, again, as we've seen. And I did wonder when I was reading that poll, if it does turn out to be the midterms often are a big election for the party out of power in Washington. I wonder how many of these Republicans in the sample are still going to say that they don't think everyone's votes were counted. But it was very much divided, with more of the Republicans in the sample saying they have real doubts, and the vast majority of the Democrats in the sample saying they're confident that the voters will be counted. And one of the surveys, the Des Moines Register, when they cover these polls, they often go back to individual respondents and they ask them. And one of the Republican respondents said, well, you know, you hear a lot of things about dead people voting. And truly, that just doesn't happen. There was the case in Nevada that where the person just pled guilty, where he had actually requested a ballot in his deceased wife's name and voted that ballot for her. But it's incredibly rare for that to happen. John Deith, who is an elections worker in Johnson County and has been for many years, he said the first thing that he does every morning is read the obituaries and cancel the voter registrations for anyone who's in the obituary. It's something that county auditors and election administrators routinely do, and people really don't have to worry about dead Iowans voting in next year's election.
Right. Something we definitely want to get in before we sign off. The president of the Iowa Senate said last week that teachers and other school employees who give what he called obscene material to students should be criminally prosecuted. We're talking about Senator Jake Chapman. Let's talk about what he said.
So he's the number two ranking Senate Republican, and it was kind of an odd position for him to take, because during last year's legislative session, he was the leading proponent of bills. He was calling himself a free speech advocate, an anti-censorship advocate, and bills that would restrict what some social media companies like Facebook could do. And he was complaining that they were censoring views. And now he's out there demanding that school districts remove certain books that have been in the public libraries for 5 or 10 years. And so, but it's something. He was in Johnston at a meeting last week. I think that he was expected to be at an Urbandale school district meeting tonight. He says that he's having legislation drafted that's going to create a new felony offense under Iowa's obscenity law. I'm not sure how that's going to work, because the obscenity law as it's currently written has an exemption for educational materials. Anything in a public library or a school library or in a museum is already exempt from the state's obscenity statute. So I think that he may have trouble even with the large majorities that Republicans have. I'm just not sure that he's going to be able to get this through, but it is something that he has said he's going to be pushing for. And because he is the Senate president, he has a lot of control over what bills come to the Senate floor. So at least in the upper chamber, if it's something that he wants, I think there's a decent chance he can get that through. Whether the House Republicans go along with it, though, there have been a number of education bills that passed the Senate and didn't get through the Iowa House. And this, I wonder if this may be another one.
And in the last couple of minutes, there are new developments involving campaign funding for Joni Ernst.
Yes, there was a group formed called Iowa Values. It was one of these dark money groups that doesn't have to disclose its donors. And a lawsuit was filed by a campaign watchdog group called the Campaign Legal Center. And they said that this group really should have filed as a political committee with the Federal Election Commission and should have disclosed its fundraising and spending. And on Friday, a federal judge in the U.S. District Court of Washington, D.C., found that the plaintiffs have standing to proceed. He rejected all of Iowa Values' arguments about why they thought the lawsuit should be dismissed. And so this case is going to go forward, and it sounds like this Campaign Legal Center has a strong case. And so we may eventually find out who contributed the money to this group. They ran extensive advertising on social media and a little bit on television, but it was primarily, I think, on social media, targeting certain demographics that were important and that Joni Ernst campaign strategists felt were important, like suburban women. And this is going to be a case that I think a lot of people in the campaign finance world are watching closely, because there are so many dark money groups that are becoming more and more involved in our elections.
And in 30 seconds, another new Iowa Register, a Des Moines Register poll shows Joni Ernst, Governor Kim Reynolds, receiving her highest marks on the economy. 56% approve of her handling of the economy. More than half approve of her overall performance. So she's in pretty good shape right now.
Yes. I mean, Morning Consult, which polls all 50 governors, they found her approval rating at 49%. The Des Moines Register poll was at 51%. So that's probably in the range of where she is. I will say that on the Morning Consult polls, she was the ninth lowest of all the 50 governors in terms of approval rating. So a lot of governors have seen more support because of how they've handled the pandemic. But she is getting relatively good numbers.
You have a great and happy Thanksgiving with you and your family, okay?
Absolutely. And you too. Stay safe, everyone.
You betcha. We are out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI Radio or its staff. Laura and I will zoom right back here in this time slot next week, we promise, with a look at the latest political activity in Iowa and what it means for all of us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We truly appreciate it, and we truly value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a great week and a very, very happy Thanksgiving.